Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Li Pingchen, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we will be talking to Dr. Peng Junyi about his new book, Mediatized Taiwanese Mandarin, Popular Culture, Masculinity, and Social Perceptions. This book was published by Springer in 2021 and is part of the Springer Sinophone and Taiwan Study book series. Dr. Peng, welcome to the show.
Hello, everyone, and thank you, Li Ping, for the introduction.
Thank you, Junyi. So, first of all, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself and your research.
Okay, sure. So I am now an associate professor of Chinese at the City University of New York. I received my PhD in linguistics also from the City University of New York, where I was working on mediatized Taiwanese Mandarin, and then which is how Taiwanese Mandarin is perceived by Chinese mainlanders and what kind of social perceptions that people in China have about our Mandarin, and then how those social perceptions formulated over time.
Sounds good, and sounds exactly about what we are the topic of the book today. And I'm looking forward to talk more later on during their interview. But before we zoom in the book, how do you started this project? Can you share with us some of the behind the scenes story?
Yeah, sure, definitely. So the project started actually very, very long time ago. So in my senior year in college, I had this opportunity to study abroad in Australia, where for the first time I encountered a lot of Chinese students from mainland China. And then whenever I talked to them, they always told me that you have this like very special accent, right? And then so for someone who grew up in Taiwan, I was never aware that I actually had an accent, because we always take accent for granted, especially if you grew up in a relatively homogenous environment. You feel like the way that you talk is considered a standard. And then so growing up in Taiwan, I never had this perception or awareness that I actually speak Mandarin with an accent. Until I had this encounter with those Chinese students from China in Australia. And what they constantly taught me was, oh, you have this accent from, you know, like the TV, like the guys on TV. And then so that really made me thinking, so what exactly does that mean to sound like the guy on the TV, right? And then so they watch a lot of Taiwanese dramas, but they had very, very little face-to-face interaction with real Taiwanese people. And then, but at the time, I didn't have any linguistic training. I was only an undergrad student. I knew so little about linguistics. And then, so I was just very curious what they actually meant by I sounded like a guy on TV. And then I had this so-called Gangtaiqiang accent, right? And then so that was where everything started. And then after that, I went into graduate school for linguistics, because language has always been my passion ever since I was in college. And then so I decided to go into graduate school to study linguistics to become a professional linguist. So while I was in the master's program, I started to think about this question, right? So what exactly do they mean by having this Gangtai Qiang? And then what exactly is the accent that I have, you know, for someone who was never aware that I had an own accent? And I was very curious, what exactly did they hear from me? And then what are the things that trigger this kind of perception that I sounded like the guy on TV? And then so in my master's program, I kind of studied the syntactic, the grammatical differences between how we use Mandarin in Taiwan and then how they use Mandarin on the mainland. And then over time, it was developing, the project developed over time, and it became a bigger and bigger and a bigger project. And then so I carry over this project into my PhD program, and I continue to study this. And then so when I was in the PhD program, I look at it not only from the language perspective, I also look at it from the sociological perspective. I wanted to know how people actually formulate this kind of perception, and then what are the things that actually trigger this kind of sociological perception, and then eventually turn into this kind of Gangtai Qiang or Taiwan Qiang that we constantly talk about. So that was kind of the story where everything started and how that developed into a PhD dissertation and later on this book project.
Yeah, thank you, Jingyi, for sharing with us the story from the what you are being considered as the so-called the guy on TV by the Chinese students, and later on developing and also on your graduate studies and your research, and later on now into a book. And I think this is definitely, you touch upon this, a very important circulation, but also perception of popular culture and also cultural production in cross-strait situation, Taiwan and China as well. So I guess first thing first, now what is Gangtai Qiang? And then you mentioned that this is the Hong Kong Taiwan accent, but I was wondering, can you talk more about what is Gangtai Qiang? And if possible, Jingyi, can you demonstrate the accent for our listeners?
Okay, sure. So in my book, I really talk a lot about Gangtai Qiang because that is like the main focus of the book. And then so my main argument for the book is that Gangtai Qiang is not actually a real speech pattern. It's really how people perceive Taiwanese Mandarin through mass media. So if a Chinese person watch a lot of Taiwanese TV shows, but then they never had the opportunity to encounter or to have this face-to-face interaction with actual Taiwanese people. And then so they would formulate this like perception or stereotypes in their mind that, oh, this is how Taiwanese people talk. And then this is what I refer to as Gangtai Qiang. Because when I first heard this term, I was very curious because I know that people in Hong Kong talk very differently from people in Taiwan, right? And then so we speak Taiwanese and Hakka and then a lot of other, you know, local Taiwanese languages. And then in Hong Kong, they speak mostly Cantonese. And then so the accent that they have when speaking Mandarin in Hong Kong is so much different from the accent that we have when we speak Mandarin in Taiwan. So when I first heard this term, Gangtai Qiang, I was very curious, so what exactly does that mean? Is that the accent from Hong Kong or is that the accent from Taiwan? And then so that is, you know, where I started to think about all this kind of language perception and media stuff. And then so I started to do a little bit of research. I want to find out where exactly does this term Gangtai Qiang come from? And then so then I talked to a lot of people, a lot of my Chinese friends from mainland China, and then asked them, so like, what exactly do you mean when you say Gangtai Qiang? Do you mean the accent from Taiwan or do you mean the accent from Hong Kong? And then later on, I realized in the 70s, when a lot of the TV shows or movies from Hong Kong went into mainland China, those TV shows and movies were actually dubbed in Taiwan. And then so for Chinese people who do not have much exposure to Taiwanese or Hong Kong people, they would have this perception that, oh, they all talk very alike because everything from Hong Kong was dubbed in Taiwan when they entered the Chinese market. And then so for the Chinese audience, Taiwanese people and Hong Kong people actually sound the same because everything that they see on the TV is dubbed pretty much by the same group of people, right? And then so that is why they later on developed this perception that, oh, people from Hong Kong and Taiwan all have this same kind of speech patterns. And then that is late, and then so that is what they perceived as Gangtaichang. But it's actually not a real speech pattern or an actual accent that people use to talk. It is what I call a mediatized variety of Mandarin. So this is a stereotype or the social perception that Chinese people formulated through the lens of media.
Sounds good. And specifically, you unpack this very interesting dimension in terms of why the Taiwanese Mandarin and Hong Kong, the Gangtaichang, are sort of like collectively referred to as Gangtaichang, even though you briefly mentioned there's like so many differences, right? Like the Taiwanese Mandarin and Hong Kong, the Cantonese in Hong Kong is very different linguistically. So so regardless of this difference, you mentioned that it is because of the practice or the strategy of dubbing in the popular culture, especially in TV and films, so on and so forth. Those cultural products, they are dubbed in Taiwan and circulated in China. And that's why you mentioned the Chinese people, they understand this kind of like speech pattern as Gangtaichang. So that's why Taiwanese Mandarin and Hong Kong languages are sort of collectively referred together. So this is the Gangtaichang, and I was wondering that in your book, you also mentioned about Taiwan Chang as well. So you mentioned, we just talked about Gangtaichang, and in different chapters and different sections, you also mentioned Taiwan Chang. So I was wondering, can you talk more about what is Taiwan Chang, and how does Taiwan Chang differ from the Gangtaichang? Or is Taiwan Chang and Taiwanese Mandarin, they are the same or they are different?
Those are very good questions. Thank you, Liping. So I think Taiwan Chang and Gangtaichang essentially are the same thing. They are really just the social perception or the stereotypes of how Taiwan and Hong Kong people talk through the lens of media. And then, but then, you know, in the 70s, Chinese people did not have a lot of exposure to the outside world. That was when the China just opened up its door to the outside world. So at the time, everything, all the information that they received was from the media, right? And then so they didn't have this kind of understanding like, oh, Taiwan is really different from Hong Kong. They have very different speech styles, and then they speak different dialects and all that. So those things were not very aware, were not known to many Chinese people at the time. But later on, as you know, Taiwanese Mandarin is increasingly recognized as a distinct variety of Mandarin, when the people realize, oh, there is actually a very big difference between the way that people talk in Taiwan and then the way that people talk in Hong Kong, people start to realize that the speech patterns in Hong Kong and Taiwan are actually very, very different. So then they start to call this Gangtaichang Taiwan Chang instead, because they now know that this is actually a speech pattern or a speech style that is unique to Taiwanese people only, but not to people in Hong Kong. And then so that's why they started to call this accent Taiwan Chang. And with the emergence of, you know, this new term Taiwan Chang, people give this term, I think, very slightly different social meanings. And then so when we used to talk about Gangtaichang like 10 or 20 years ago, Gan Taichung was perceived as being very cosmopolitan. It was very like business-like, and that it has a urban lifestyle attached to it. But then when people talk about Taiwanqiang, it is a very different perception from Gan Taichung. So people get a lot of this Taiwanqiang from a lot of our idol dramas, right? So for example, the most well-known one is Material Garden, Liu Xing Hua Yuan. And then so that is when this accent was really known to the Taiwanese people, to the Chinese people as Taiwanqiang. And then so this accent, Taiwanqiang, is perceived more as like this very cutesy, feminine, and also polite, friendly kind of way. So it is no longer how it was perceived 30 years ago, as people would tell you that Gan Taichung sounds very cosmopolitan, urban, and nice. But then for Taiwanqiang, it's more like, you know, it's very cute, it's very feminine, and it's very like babyish on the other side of the spectrum. And then so although they are essentially the same thing, they are all the stereotypes that Chinese people have about how Taiwanese people talk through the lens of media, but that they have been given very different social perceptions, and those perceptions came from very different social contexts as well.
Yeah, and then thank you especially for unpacking this development of this kind of linguistic category of Gan Taichung or Taiwanqiang. And especially you mentioned this understanding, the changing understanding, and even the different imagination and stereotypes of Taiwanqiang through different moments in our contemporary era. So I guess now I will focus my question on specifically on Taiwanese Mandarin. And then you mentioned that it's a now recognized a particular a variety of Mandarin and Taiwanese Mandarin. So Jingyi, do you want to speak briefly in Taiwanese Mandarin so our listeners can get a taste about what Taiwanese Mandarin sounds like?
Okay. So do you want me to talk in Mandarin now?
Yes.
Okay, sure. 所以台湾腔就比较像是我们平常这样子讲话的方式，然后可能有时候我们在句尾的时候会说好啊，好哦，可以啊，真的吗？类似像这样子的这些语尾的助词啊。So a lot of those like sentence final particles that we use in our Mandarin is really, really salient to the Chinese mainlanders. And then whenever you speak like that, they'll be like, oh, this is very Taiwanese. And then so that is really the perception of Taiwanese Mandarin. And then also, like I said, Taiwanese Mandarin is... So Gan Taichung is only represents part of Taiwanese Mandarin, right? Because Taiwanese Mandarin is also a very broad way of speaking, because if you're from Taipei, you're from Kaohsiung, or you're from, you know, from Taichung, and those different cities have different their own regional varieties of Mandarin as well. So what exactly is Taiwanese Mandarin, right? And then so even the term Taiwanese Mandarin cannot really cover all the different ways of talking of people in Taiwan. And then so but then Taiwanese Mandarin, when linguists talk about Taiwanese Mandarin, we try to focus on the actual features that the majority of Taiwanese people use in their daily life speech. So here are some examples. So like I said previously, the sentence final particles are some of the very salient features of Taiwanese Mandarin. And then what is also common to Taiwanese Mandarin is the drop of er sound, right? And then so if you are familiar with Beijing Mandarin, they have a lot of the er sound at the end, not just at the end of the phrase or sentence, but also they do the zhi chi shi sound very salient, in a very salient way. Whereas in Taiwanese Mandarin, sometimes lao shi, lao si, you know, we don't really make an effort to make this distinction between zhi chi shi and z zi zi zi, those sounds. And then so those are something considered a very unique feature of Taiwanese Mandarin. Although a lot of Southern Chinese speakers also use these kind of features. They drop the R's as well. But then whenever people hear this drop of R sound, they usually associate that with Taiwanese Mandarin. And then another feature that we hear a lot is the N and the NG sound. So 学生, 学生 and 学生, right? And then so in Taiwanese Mandarin, we would say 学生 a lot. But then in standard Mandarin or the Beijing Mandarin, so to speak, you would say 学生, right? So you will make this NG sound more salient than people would in Taiwanese Mandarin. And then so the nasal, how we produce the nasal sounds is also different from standard Mandarin in Beijing. Also, there we have this tendency to replace all the neutral tones with four tones, right? So instead of saying 学生, we would say 学生, right? So we drop a lot of the neutral tones, and then instead we would use a regular tone instead. So instead of saying 朋友, we would say 朋友. So we use the third tone to replace the neutral tone. So those are all very salient phonological features of Taiwanese Mandarin. And syntactic-wise, one of the very well-known feature of Taiwanese Mandarin is the use of yo, right? And then so we have this tendency in Taiwanese Mandarin to use yo as an aspect marker, which means we would say 我有看过这部电影, or 我有吃过这道菜. So that means I had this experience before. So as the markers of completion of an action. But in standard Mandarin, this is not a grammatical feature for many of people from northern part of China. And then so they will always tell you 我没吃过这道菜, or 我没看过这部电影, or 我吃过了我看过了这部电影. They wouldn't even use 有 in their sentence as a marker of completion. But then that feature is so common in Taiwanese Mandarin and also in a lot of southern varieties of Mandarin because many southern dialects of Chinese, such as Taiwanese, Hakka, Cantonese, they all have this 有 feature in their dialect. And then so when we speak Mandarin, there is this tendency that the feature will transfer into the way that we speak Mandarin. And then so we get a lot of those features actually from Taiwanese and from Hakka, because those are the two most spoken local vernaculars here in Taiwan. So when we speak Mandarin, a lot of those features would automatically transfer into the way that we speak Mandarin. So those are some of the very common features observed by linguists. But then obviously, not everybody use those features, right? And then so it is really just statistically, we found that a lot of people would have those features in their speech. And then we refer to those features collectively as Taiwanese Mandarin. But then again, when people say Taiwan Qiang or Gang Tai Qiang, that is a social stereotype about Taiwanese Mandarin. But again, that is not the actual way that people talk.
Yeah, thank you, Jingyi, for sharing with us the different features of Taiwan Qiang and also the comparison as well, the Taiwanese Mandarin and also the Beijing Mandarin. And then in this like five different features, and specifically, I appreciate you mentioned that there's this diversity, there's a differences within the Taiwanese Mandarin itself, especially when we think about the multi-ethnic society, that different communities, they actually speak Mandarins one way or another differently as well. So I appreciate you mentioned the point of diversity, even though now we sort of seem to talk about Taiwanese Mandarin as one linguistic category, but yes, there are some diversities and differences within this group. And so now we'll be moving on to the Taiwanese Mandarin, and especially thinking about Taiwanese Mandarin, the development, the practices of Taiwanese Mandarin in historical views. That is, you know, from the nationalist government, they moved to Taiwan, and all this Sinocentric regime, but specifically about linguistic policies and also Mandarin education in Taiwan. From they move here, I mean, move to Taiwan, and then from the 50s. And so I was wondering, can you talk a little bit about how is Taiwanese Mandarin evolving, and especially from this nationalist strategy for education and promotion, and now to nowadays?
Sure. So as we all know, after World War II, the Nationalist Party moved to Taiwan, and then they wanted to take control of the island. And then so at the time, there were some different dialects spoken on the island, right? And then there were Taiwanese, there were Hakka, and then there were some Japanese also. And then so for the sake of communication, they want to promote the use of Mandarin throughout the island. And then so they made this rule that everybody at school should speak Mandarin only. With this Mandarin only policy, so a lot of people will speak their home, can only speak their home dialect, which is, you know, Taiwanese or Hakka at home. And then when they come to school, they all have to use Mandarin. And then, so this is a very typical case of what we called language contact. So language contact is when two languages are spoken at the same place by the same group of people, right? And then so what happened in language contact is one language will have an effect on the other. That is a very obvious outcomes of, you know, language contact. And then so very naturally, a lot of people carry the way that they speak Taiwanese and the Hakka over into the way that they speak Mandarin, right? And then so with this language contact, we had a lot of new features coming into the Taiwanese Mandarin. And then at the time, we were not allowed to have any sort of contact with mainland China. And then so after the separation for 50 years, mainland Mandarin and Taiwanese Mandarin just like diverged in their own way, and then developed their own ways of speech and own ways of like features and how they use different, you know, phonological and syntactic features. And then so that it was sort of like this historical development of Taiwanese Mandarin. And then more and more, we got this like influence of from Japan, right? Because we used to be the Japanese colony. And then so in a lot of ways, we adopted this kind of Japanese like cuteness or very feminine kind of a speech style in popular culture. And then people think, oh, that is such a cute way of talking. And then so people associate a lot of those features with femininity, right? And then so a lot of girls want to sound cute on, you know, on social media or on TV. And then so they would pick up those like Japanese kind of like cute features in the way that they speak Mandarin. And then so more and more, those kind of like cutesy, feminine kind of style go into the way that we speak Mandarin over time. And then so now it becomes this kind of what Chinese people call a very cute and, you know, feminine way of talking. So that was like a really, really brief introduction of how Taiwanese Mandarin evolved over the last 50 years when the Nationalist Party brought the language to Taiwan, and then how they interact with the local languages first. And then later on, people pick up the speech style from Japan in popular culture. And then that the way, you know, Mandarin was spoken is now developed into the way that we hear on TV these days.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, thank you, Jingyi. And especially appreciate you mentioned that there this kind of localization, right? Like localization of Mandarin. One way is this kind of linguistically localized. I just want to highlight the example you mentioned earlier in terms of yo, right? So sometimes this kind of inclusion of yo is one way or another might be influenced by the Taiwanese Hokkien use of the language, and it's sort of kind of like mixed in the Mandarin speaking as well. And another trajectory you also briefly mentioned is this kind of localization in relation to Taiwan's history of serial colonization as well, the Japanese influence and also the nationalist government, the kind of like Chinese ideology in the linguistic education and performance. And lastly, you mentioned this kind of like cutified, right? The kind of cutified trend of Mandarin. And then, so these are the two major dimension that you mentioned about the involvement, evolution of Taiwanese Mandarin. So with that said, and also to think about, you know, from the 50s to nowadays, you know, the language is evolving, right? And also to, then my question will be about the perception as well. The perception about this language in, you know, changing and also evolving. So how has the Taiwanese Mandarin acquired different social meanings locally and also in China or even globally as well?
That is an excellent question. So that was also the main focus of this book, right? And then so I was really interested in how the social perceptions of Taiwanese Mandarin really changed over time given different social meanings, the different contexts and power dynamics and all that. And then so in the 70s, when China first opened up its, you know, the country to the world, they had this a lot of cultural product, like we talk about, coming into the mainland. And then so for the first time, the younger generation had exposure to the outside world, especially the Chinese-speaking community outside of China. And then so they watched a lot of, you know, Taiwanese TV shows, you know, movies from Hong Kong, music from both Hong Kong and Taiwan and all that. And then so at the time, Taiwan was a lot more economically more advanced than mainland China. And so people had this perception that, oh, this is how Taiwanese people speak. And this is how, you know, if you live a very urban kind of style, this is how you would talk. And then so through the influence of media, people formulate this kind of perception of Taiwanese Mandarin. And then so in a way, media really builds this connection between linguistic practices and also the language ideologies, right? And then so they connect. So through media or the TV programs that they watched, Chinese people establish this kind of connection between the urban lifestyle and also the, you know, the weight of speech. And so people start to have this like a perception that, oh, if you live in a like urban kind of area, this is the way that you would talk. And then so people assigned this what we call social meanings to Taiwanese Mandarin. And then so that was what happened in the 70s. And then so if you ask, so my experience in my research has been that whenever you ask people, you know, in their 50s or 60s, they will always tell you very positive things about Taiwanese Mandarin. They'll be like, oh, this sounds very nice, and it sounds very educated, it sounds very cosmopolitan, and then that really represents an urban lifestyle, and we watch a lot of those, you know, Taiwanese dramas growing up, and then so we really love the accent. So this is a kind of, that's a very typical response that I got from my, you know, research participants who are in their 50s and 50s and 60s. But then if you ask the younger generation, so whenever I talk to the college students, they will always tell you, oh, Taiwanese Mandarin sounds very feminine. It sounds very cute, very polite, but in a way, I can't really take it very seriously because it just sounds like so girly and babyish, right? And then so I found out that the perception of Taiwanese Mandarin really changed over time. And then so that really got me thinking, so what are the causes of those attitudinal changes? And then so I look at the media, I look at how people, you know, talk on media and how those actors and actresses project themselves on TV, and also you know, those talk show hosts, how they host the shows and all that. And I really found that over time, like we talked, people pick a lot of like different speech styles from the Japanese culture, and then we are becoming more and more influenced in our popular culture by the Japanese culture, and then so that people try to project this new persona and using a different way of speech, and then they start to incorporate this sort of like very cute style into their speech. And then so these days, if you watch TV shows, you will really found that the way that people talk is already very different from how people talk, you know, 30 years ago. And then so media definitely plays a very important role in this changing attitude. And then one thing that has also changed a lot over the last 30 years was the power dynamics between China and Taiwan, right? And then so Taiwan is no longer perceived as this very urban or cosmopolitan place by the younger generation in China, because they have all the, you know, all the crazy big cities, all the high rises, all the modern lifestyles now, right? And so when they look at Taiwan, they no longer see Taiwan as this like very urban or cosmopolitan place. Instead, it is perceived more like a very cute little island, or you know, a place where people are very friendly and polite. And then so those perceptions of Taiwanese people or Taiwan in general has also transferred into the way that they perceive the language. And then so over time, with the power dynamics, the changing power dynamics between Taiwan and China, people also changed their perception of the way that Taiwanese people talk. And then so media, power dynamics, and then popular culture, those are some of the very important factors that I found in my own research that substantially influence the social perception of Taiwanese Mandarin by Chinese mainlanders over time.
Yeah, thank you, Jingyi, for touch upon these three very important and interesting dimensions. Mm-hmm. First is generational differences. You mentioned that your participant, they will respond or they perceived Taiwanese Mandarin very differently in their different age group. And then the second dimension, you also mentioned that this this interregional or this inter-Asian network of cultural product circulation. Again, you mentioned this kind of Japanese soft power, right? And how that is very popular in Taiwan and also other places in Asia as well. So this kind of circulation, inter-Asian circulation, network of circulation. And lastly, you mentioned this kind of contemporary cross-strait geopolitics, how that changing power dynamics, I mean, you know, back in the 50s and 70s, Cold War, and now contemporary, how that changing, shifting geopolitical landscape also, one way or another, shape the perception, understanding, or even, as you mentioned, imagination or stereotype of Taiwanese Mandarin. So you mentioned how media shape and also circulate and popularize Gangtaichang in China. And I was wondering, can you elaborate a little bit more about what kind of media that you are talking about? So I remember in different chapters, you mentioned about this kind of talk show on TV, so on and so forth. But I was wondering, is there also like other trajectories, for example, like films or other different cultural products in the media circulation?
Yes. So in my study, I mostly just look at TV shows, but then not just TV shows on TV. So I was interested in any sort of platforms where you can watch those shows, right? And then so the most important thing that we know about media and language is we all, if you watch shows a lot, and then over time, there is a possibility that you will pick up those features that that you think it's really cool, and that, or things that you think very positively. And then so, but if you don't really like the show, or you think people, you know, the people that you see on TV are not cool, and then you have a very negative perception of the show, most likely you won't pick up those features. And then so traditionally in sociolinguistics, there is this theory called speech accommodation theory. So the theory, speech accommodation theory, says that if you have, you know, face-to-face interaction with people, and then over time, you will pick up those features from the person or people that you are talking to. And that is what they call speech accommodation. But then when it comes to media, a lot of people are very skeptical about this theory. They would be like, if you watch the TV show, you don't really interact with the people in the TV, right? So you don't really interact with the characters in the show. And then so how would you still pick up features from the TV shows? And then so my main argument was that if you really like the show, and that you have a positive attitude towards the show, and that eventually you will still pick up some features here and there from the shows that you watch. But then if you don't really like the show and you think it's very, you know, dumb, stupid, and it's not perceived very positively by yourself, and then you will not pick up the features that you watch from TV. So my study has been focusing on TV shows, but it's not just TV shows on TV, but also if you can watch the TV shows from different platforms, such as, you know, on the internet or Netflix and a lot of other platforms that you can watch, as long as you can see the characters, that sort of gives you the social contacts, and then you can hear them talk, and then that's the media that I was interested in. And then so I look at, when I did my survey, I asked people, like, you know, how often you watch those shows, but then not necessarily on TV, but also from the internet and from a lot of different platforms. So wherever you have access to those shows, dramas, or whatever, and then I will consider that a media platform that can have a potential impact on people's speech behavior.
Yeah, and then especially you mentioned that it's not just about TV, right? Like cable TV, but nowadays, you know, we have the rise of digital media and also the internet as well. And then a lot of different sources here and there in internet. And so the accessibility, right? The accessibility and also exposure of the Taiwanese Mandarin could be through very different variety of channels in everyday life. So we talk about media, and then we also talk about language ideology previously, and especially about how Taiwanese Mandarin is being perceived by some. You mentioned it's desirable. It seems to be this educated or cosmopolitan profile to the speaker. But you also mentioned for some people, it seemed to be quote unquote awkward, or it's more like those undesirable feature in the Mandarin practice. So with this perception from the Chinese people. And I was wondering that, because nowadays Taiwanese people actually consumed and watch a lot of TV shows from China. And then, you know, for all the dramas, the talk shows, and also variety shows. So my question for you is that, even though this may be outside the scope of this book, but I'm interested to hear your thoughts, or maybe some observation that you can share with us, that how the recent rise of Chinese cultural production, and especially in Putonghua, how that impact the practice, the speaking of Taiwanese Mandarin?
That's a really, really good question, Liping. I feel like there is also definitely a reverse impact on Taiwanese Mandarin from mainland China, because just like you said, there are so many shows from China that people watch in Taiwan these days. And then so I feel like over time we will pick up. So I think I have already noticed a lot of the phrases or the pronunciations and stuff that has been picked up by Taiwanese people. And then so I feel like over time, there will be more and more features from Beijing Mandarin entering Taiwanese Mandarin. And then so there is definitely this like reverse effect going on in Taiwan, especially on the way that we talk. And then so definitely I have noticed that people pick up words such as what are some of the very common words that we will use that's from China, for example, kao pu, right? And then so there are a lot of other expressions that I couldn't think of off the top of my head, but then if you pay attention to the daily life speech of Taiwanese people, and then you will definitely notice a lot of the phrases that are actually from China through media as well. So definitely that is happening more and more. I think like over time, that will be there will be more and more vocabulary or syntactic structures or phonological features going into Taiwanese Mandarin from China.
Yeah, I think about one phrase that 视频. So there, this term has appeared more and more, especially now we have all the digital media and social media platform. So what we call video in Taiwan, and then some people start to use 视频 to refer to video instead of 影片. Yeah, so but I think this is definitely one great example to think about Taiwanese Mandarin as a living language, right? So it's a living language, people are using it, that's why there's still this kind of different changes and evolving as well, still evolving because it is a living language. And So with this Taiwanese Mandarin and also perception, you mentioned this briefly earlier as well, but I was wondering whether you can talk a little bit more about why or how is Taiwanese Mandarin, or the so-called Gangdaichang, specifically associated with cuteness or with this kind of cutified pattern of speech, or in some contexts associated with sa jiao. So how it seems that all these are sort of kind of like feminine sort of kind of like a profile to the Taiwanese Mandarin speaker. So I was wondering, can you talk about the association or a connection between the two?
Sure, definitely. So I feel like a lot of the shows that people watch from Taiwan are idol dramas, right? And then so those idol dramas are essentially made for a female audience. And then so a lot of the times the people talk or, you know, is catered to their female audience. And then so, of course, the girls want to be like really, really cute. And then the guys also want to be like really like mellow and, you know, soft and caring, that kind of features. And then so that really gives the language the characters as well. So it's not just the characters, they have personalities, that their personalities also transferred onto the language. And then so that is why I said that media really plays this role of formulating but also fortifying this link, semiotic link between linguistic practices and the social ideologies. And then so by watching all those TV dramas made for women, and then people over time pick up this kind of concept that, oh, Taiwanese people really talk in a very feminine way. But it's mostly because of the genre of the shows that they watch, right? It's not that they have a very comprehensive exposure to different aspects of life of Taiwanese people, but they only have this one very single aspect of, you know, Taiwanese lifestyle, and especially when those shows are made specifically for women. And then so people pick up this kind of like features that, oh, this is how, you know, women would talk, and this is how guys would talk when they are talking to women and all that. And then so over time, people have developed this perception that Taiwanese, you know, people talk in a very, very feminine way.
Yeah, and then specifically the gendered perceptions of Taiwanese Mandarin and also the speakers as well. And then in your book, you mentioned that this is this kind of new type of masculinity, and you describe it as this kind of soft masculinity associated with cuteness or as a more feminine element in their speech. And so I was wondering, can you talk more about how this new type of the soft masculinity, as it is associated with Taiwanese Mandarin, how this new type of soft masculinity reshaping or redefining the model of masculinity or the masculine language in the Sinophone world?
Okay, sure. So towards the end of my book, I start to think, okay, so what exactly is considered feminine, right? So when people tell me, oh, your way of talking is very feminine, what exactly does they mean by feminine? What are the features or what are the characteristics of, you know, femininity that they're talking about? And then so I started to do a lot of kind of research on femininity and also masculinity in different cultural contexts, right? And then so, of course, in different cultural contexts, there are different definitions of femininity and masculinities, right? And then so in Asia recently, there is this new models of masculinity going on from the influence of K-pop, the Korean popular culture, right? And then we have seen a lot of those like K-pop stars that, you know, they are male, but then they put on a lot of makeup, and then they dress in a very gender neutral way, or what we call androgynous way, right? And then they become extremely popular among the younger generation. And then they present a very different type of, you know, masculinity. They are considered non-conformist, right? They are considered with this very youth, independent, non-conformist identity. And then so they become very, very well accepted by the younger generation, not by everyone, but then by the younger generation especially. And then so this kind of image also goes into a lot of the shows that we have, right, in Taiwanese dramas. And so when So those guys would dress up like those K-pop star, or they have like the makeup, the hairstyle, or the or the overall style. It's very androgynous, right? And that it's not considered. So when I look at a lot of studies by Korean scholars, they said it's not feminine. You know, putting on makeup for men, it's not a feminine thing, but it's a new ways of looking at male identity. It's a new way of looking at what exactly is modern masculinity. And then, so this kind of new concepts or ideas really come across Asia, not just into Taiwan, but also into China, Japan, and a lot of East Asian countries. And then so over time, those like Korean dramas and K-pop are really reshaping how people perceive what masculinity is. But then for people who are not yet influenced by this, or people who are not acceptive of this kind of influence, they would see Taiwanese Mandarin or they would see this culture as, you know, being very feminine or being not like a man or, you know, stuff like that. And then so this new kind of masculinity is still changing how people think of what a man should be like, or what is considered a masculine speech style, or what is considered a feminine speech style. But then we do not have a definite answer for that one yet, because that is still changing our perception over time. So toward the end of the book, I kind of want to draw on this conclusion that our perception is really dynamic. Our perception of language is really dynamic. It's not only the way that we talk, but also it is in the social it is a lot about the social context, right? So how we perceive femininity, how we perceive masculinity, and those perceptions will transfer into the way that we perceive languages as well. And then so with this new type of new type of masculinities and femininity coming into Taiwan and also into China, and then that are those new concepts of gender are also reshaping the way that we look at our own and other people's languages.
Yeah, thank you, Jingyi. And especially you touch upon also, I mean, in addition to J-pop and Japanese drama, but also definitely K-pop and K-drama, that's immensely popular in Taiwan as well. So I definitely appreciate you mentioned that the connection or a consumption even of the Korean cultural products. And also you mentioned this very important point in terms of how the language practice or language perception actually also reveal language ideology. And that language ideology is actually informed, should be contextualized with the social context as well. And then you mentioned that this masculinity and how it is being perceived with more like feminine features. And also, I guess one way is also to think about this kind of like the social context is, you know, one way or another, still kind of like the undercurrent is still this heteronormativity that to kind of like categorize as masculinity and femininity, but in a way that, you know, nowadays it's a very diverse life. So I guess this is something that when I hearing you unpacking the gendered perception, then I was thinking about the ideology and also, I mean, of course, K-pop and K-drama as well. All right. So thank you, Jingyi, for sharing with us the thoughts and some of the highlights from the book. And so now we are towards the last section for our interview. So per our tradition, so I will be asking you the traditional final question here at New Books Network. So Jingyi, can you share with us what you're working on right now, or what's your next project, your next plan will be?
So my next project will be looking at the role of gender in language acquisition. So as a linguist and also a language instructor, I have always been really interested in how people acquire Mandarin as a second language. And then more recently, after I finished this book project on Taiwanese Mandarin and how language media and also genders are really influenced the way that we perceive languages, I want to look at how exactly gender plays a role in language acquisition. So I got my initial idea when I went to some of those language meetups in New York. So as you probably know that in New York, there are a lot of different kind of meetups where people gather together for similar interests and stuff like that. And one of the very popular meetups is language meetups, right? And then so sometimes I go to those Mandarin meetups to meet with people and to practice Mandarin with them. And then so I found that there are different like communicative strategies that people would use at those meetups, right? And then so male and females, sometimes they use very different, you know, communication strategies when they approach, you know, new people, when they approach people that, you know, they meet for the first time. And then so the how they make their transitions of topics and how people, where do people take pauses and where do people, you know, take turns to talk and all that. I feel like if you really look at their way of using those communicative strategies, you really find that men and women, they take very different strategies when they talk to people. And then as a result, that also has an impact on the way that they acquire a foreign language. And then so my next project, I was really interested in how, you know, gender influenced the way that we acquire languages. So I'm not just looking at, you know, meetups in New York, but I also look at a lot of the migrant workers in Taiwan. And then so over the past 10 years, we have been getting a lot of migrant workers, mostly female, right, from Southeast Asian countries working in Taiwan. And then so they, for them, they work, a lot of them work as domestic helpers in the family setting. And then how they communicate with the family members, how they communicate with the kids, with the grandmoms, or with the husband and with the wife, is also very crucial to the study of gender in second language acquisition. And then so as a female worker in a foreign household, what kind of communicative strategy they take in order to communicate with the people that host them? And then with that kind of strategies, how do they acquire Mandarin over time without very little formal instruction? And then so that would be my next step in my research, and it's something that we're really, really interested to find out more.
Yeah, that sounds very interesting, and especially the migrant workers and also the so-called new immigrants in Taiwan. Mm-hmm. They moved to Taiwan for work or for many different reasons. I guess this is also partly related to what we mentioned earlier in terms of the diversity in Taiwan as well. The community composition, the linguistic practice, but also, you know, for the religious practice, so on and so forth as well. And language is definitely one of the very important feature for this diverse Taiwan. All right, so that sounds good. And looking forward to your maybe next book about this project. Yeah. So, Jingyi, I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed our conversation. I want to thank you, our audience, for listening to the end. And this will be the last part of our interview for today and also for this year, 2021. So I hope everyone take good care and staying safe, and see you next time in 2022. Goodbye.
Bye.